Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we've been studying the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. That's sutta number 27 in the middle length discourses. And so far we have been discussing what I call the main paradigm of the gradual training according to the Majjhima Nikaya, or middle length discourses. And so far within the gradual training, I explained what I call the precondition for the gradual training. That is the arising of the Buddha in the world, his teaching of the Dhamma, then the person going forth, hearing the Dhamma, going forth, acquiring faith, going forth into homelessness. Then there comes the undertaking of the gradual training, which begins with the training in moral restraint, or sila. And one fulfills the noble aggregate, what's called the noble aggregate of virtue, by undertaking restraint in bodily action, restraint relating to speech, restraint relating to right livelihood, and one experiences contentment with the simple basic requisites of the robes, an alms bowl to support oneself, and other basic simple requisites, just enough to support one's material existence without need for any excessive luxuries. Then, grounded upon this moral restraint, this training in virtue, one trains in the restraint of the senses. That is, one restrains in controlling the sense faculties so that the senses do not run wild in pursuit of attractive sense objects. And the senses do not become disturbed by unattractive or irritating sense objects. And in this process of practicing sense restraint, one is really exercising restraint over the mind. And though it's not explicitly stated in the gradual training, but I assume it almost as fundamental that the monk here, from the time he goes forth, takes up ordination, you will be given a meditation object. And so this practice of moral restraint, this restraint of the senses, is undertaken within the framework of developing a meditation practice. And it is this rootedness of the mind in the meditation practice which enables one to be mindful of one's bodily action, mindful of one's speech, mindful of one's little actions so that they constitute right livelihood, and to experience this contentment with the simplest, most basic requisites. It's also this rooting of the mind in the meditation practice that enables one to be mindful in one's dealings with the outside world, so that one can practice restraint of the senses. When one encounters attractive objects, one will be able to pull the mind away from them back to the meditation object. When one experiences irritating objects, disturbing objects, one will be able to pull the mind away from them back to the meditation object, or just observe them as impersonal phenomena, just impinging on the senses, coming and going. Okay, then the next step in the gradual training is here translated as full awareness, or now I prefer the translation clear comprehension. The Pali word is sampajanya. This is also translated clear knowing. It's a full awareness, clear understanding of one's purposes, one's motives in undertaking all the many little actions in day-to-day life, acting with a kind of circumspection, acting wisely, judiciously. And again, this clear comprehension will be often coupled with and rooted in mindfulness. Not exactly the same as mindfulness, but the two qualities, mindfulness and clear comprehension, often go together. So mindfulness provides, I would say, what I call the element of awareness, and clear comprehension is the element of understanding. So it gets confusing because Bhikkhu Nyanamoli had translated clear comprehension as awareness. Okay, so now the monk in this formative stage of his development is exercising his training in the precepts and moral restraint, this training and restraint of the senses, this training and clear comprehension. And this process of training may go on for even an extended period of time. It might be several years until he's considered strong enough, developed enough to go off into seclusion. According to the Vinaya, the book called the Monastic Discipline, the newly ordained monk is supposed to remain under the guidance of his teacher or preceptor for a period of 5 years before he's considered even fit to be considered for independence, to be given independence. And if he's not qualified, then that period of dependency, of guidance, might have to be extended. Okay, so now the Buddha here, though he's giving a very condensed or compressed teaching, so we're considering the case of somebody who goes through all of these stages quite quickly. And so now the Buddha describes the disciple. Now we come to paragraph 17, which in my outline is the next stage, which I call resorting to a secluded dwelling. Okay, so now come to paragraph 17. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue and this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, a dwelling place. That is the forest. The forest is considered a very suitable dwelling place. In Pali, this is Aranya. In Chinese, it would be Lan Ruo. And this place is Tongjing Lan Ruo. The root, actually the foot of a tree. In South Asia, India, Sri Lanka, the many trees, the root, at the foot of a tree, it's like a big root comes out and extends over a long distance. And so one could live at the root of the tree, but it's not the root going underground, but it's the root that's above the ground, which sort of just spreads out and it creates almost like a triangle, like two roots create a triangular space, and then the ground slopes down like this, and so one can live quite comfortably in that triangle created by the two roots at the base of the tree. I say quite comfortably, but there's always the problem of ants, snakes. Okay, a mountain, side of a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, very daring, more courageous meditators might want to seek out what's called here a charnel ground, sometimes translated as cemetery, but it's not so much a place where dead bodies are buried very quite safely and securely underground, but it's a place where the bodies of the dead are either thrown away to decompose, or where bodies are cremated and then just the remains of the cremations are left. A jungle thicket, an open space, or a heap of straw. And so one chooses such a secluded dwelling place. And now the monk, the meditator, comes to, now that he's chosen this secluded dwelling place, he comes to the real struggle or battle to achieve self-conquest. And that will be the struggle, the initial struggle to overcome, to master the major obstacles of the mind, which the Buddha has collected under the heading of the five hindrances, pancha nivarana. So here the Buddha describes a monk who, on returning from his alms round, after his meal, he'll take a little rest because he might have walked an hour, half an hour going to this village where he collects his alms food, half an hour back, he's taken his meal. And so after that long, tiring trip, he takes a little rest. Then after he regains his energy, then he will begin his earnest practice. So he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and establishes mindfulness before him. Sometimes this phrase, establishing mindfulness before him, is interpreted to mean that one is practicing mindfulness of breathing, that it means setting up mindfulness at the nostrils or at the upper lip. But that's, I think, too narrow an interpretation. I take this to be just a kind of metaphorical expression that one sets up to mean that one is setting up mindfulness, and that the expression before him, parimukkang satting upatthapetva, parimukkang is pari, to be taken to me around, and mukang, the face. So literally it would be around the face, but I don't think it should be taken too literally, around the face, meaning around here. I would say it could be taken in a very general way as just expressing the idea of setting up mindfulness, being mindful, being vigilant, being alert. Okay, these five hindrances are, first of all, the text uses the word covetousness, which in English perhaps today doesn't mean very much. But the more common in Pali, the word abhijja, also it's a rather obscure term, even in Pali. But most passages on the five hindrances use another word with a clearer meaning, kama chanda, which means sensual desire, sensual lust. The second hindrance is ill will, anger, resentment. The third, I use the common rendering sloth and torpor. But what this actually means, sloth is dullness of the mind. It's the mind which is like a day when there is a cloudy sky, gray, cloudy sky, and the clouds don't move. Just nothing seems to happen through the whole day. So it's kind of sterile type of mind. And torpor, nidra, that is drowsiness, sleepiness. Not the natural sleepiness that comes upon one at night when one is naturally sleepy, but it's that sleepiness that comes unexpectedly when one seems perfectly awake, but the mind gets fixated and cannot arouse, you cannot arouse energy, cannot awaken the mind, and then it becomes very heavy, dull. First it becomes dull, and then this drowsiness seeps into the mind. And then the opposite of that is the fourth. Okay, so the third hindrance, I use the common translation sloth and torpor, but we might also render it dullness and drowsiness. These are actually two distinct qualities, but they're both similar in that they have a sluggish, they're similar and they both share in the sluggish nature, the characteristic of sluggishness. They both tend to impede the movement of the mind. They both obscure the alertness, the brightness of the mind. The fourth hindrance is also made up of two components. One is called in Pali Udaccha Kukucha. Udaccha, I render restlessness. Restlessness is excitement, agitation, the inability to settle down. It's a constant flow of excited thoughts, where thought succeeds thought without interruption. And the thoughts are scattered, dispersed, distracted. And counterpart of that is kukucha, here rendered remorse. For remorse is maybe the more extreme form. Kukucha is just the sense of having done something that one should not have done, or having neglected to do something that one should have done. Maybe we'd even use this word guilt, but old guilt maybe carries along too many connotations from Christianity. But it's the disturbance of the conscience over, not over any kind of great moral evils, but little acts of commission and omission, kind of pangs of regret, agitation over things that one has done and neglected to do. And then the fifth hindrance is vichikicca, which means doubt. This is not serious intellectual doubt. That is what the Buddha encourages, the kind of doubt that leads one to investigation. But this is doubt, is the inability to place trust and confidence in the teacher, the Buddha as the teacher, and in the Dhamma as the teaching, as the path. For those who really want to learn very well, I will write the Pali equivalents of these, particularly for the Pali students in the class. Excuse me? But it's a nice poem. Did somebody copy the poem? Do you have it? Okay, so these are the five hindrances. And to overcome these five hindrances, the Buddha has taught many methods, many strategies. I'm not going to go into them in detail here. As we go along studying the suttas, we'll come across suttas that deal more specifically with the ways to deal with specific hindrances. But in this little passage on the abandoning of the hindrances, there are what I call hints or very brief allusions, indications of some of the methods that are used. So first we come to the overcoming of covetousness or sensual desire. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. It makes it sound very simple. But what is meant here, as I said, is the overcoming of sensual desire. And one of the most powerful meditations that the Buddha teaches for the overcoming of sensual desire is a meditation which is called the Asubha Sanya, which means the perception of the unattractive nature of the physical body. This involves the contemplation of the physical body in terms of its constituents, taking one's own body first, analyzing, visualizing one's own body in terms of its components, beginning with the external components, the hairs of the head, hairs of the body, nails, fingernails, toenails, teeth, skin, and going skin, nails, skin, teeth, nails, hair of the body, hair of the head, then going forward, then going inside the body, exploring the body by way of muscles, bones, the different organs, tissues, fluids, and then familiarizing oneself systematically with all of the components of the body till one can see the body inside and out and really sense the nature of the body. And by doing this repeatedly, systematically, over and over, gradually the idea of the body as being something attractive, desirable, enticing, alluring, fades away. Of course, superficially the body will appear attractive, but using that inner vision of meditation, when one experiences that attraction, one just applies that inner vision of meditation, and one will start seeing the body in terms of its components, and the attractiveness, the allure, will fade away, and one will actually perceive the body sanjanati, one perceives it as the subhuto, unattractive, impure, not in a moral sense, but just physically unattractive. And this, I should add that this practice is not intended in any way to instill kind of disgust for the body or a loathing for the body, but it's a therapeutic device used to overcome sensual desire. Then ill will, anger, the two of these five hindrances, two are the powerful hindrances. Three are, in their own right, they're quite strong, but compared to the other two, they're subordinate. The two powerful hindrances are sensual desire and ill will. The three subordinate hindrances are numbers 3, 4, and 5. Okay, so sensual lust and ill will, these are like the opposite pair, attraction and aversion. So ill will is to be overcome by loving kindness and compassion. So coming to the text, abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Okay, so the means, the method to overcome ill will and hatred is by the development, the special method, specific means for overcoming ill will and hatred is the development of loving kindness or metta, developing metta as a meditation subject. One takes the wish for one's own welfare and happiness, using that as the standard or measuring rod for understanding that all other beings wish to be well and happy, and then working systematically with different groups of people, one starts generating the wish that they will be well and happy. One works through these different groups till one is able to generate this real warmth and deep concern for their welfare and happiness, and then one starts expanding that loving concern for the welfare of others to wider and wider circles of being, until one is able to radiate the mind of loving kindness to first to the different quarters of the world, the eastern direction, south, north, west, above, below, then to the whole world, to all beings throughout the entire world. And in this way, one purifies the mind from ill will and hatred. Then, to overcome sloth and torpor, dullness and drowsiness, abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of life, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Okay, sloth and torpor, even when the mind is relatively free from sensual desire and ill will, but still this dullness and drowsiness can creep into the mind. And so to overcome this, the Buddha teaches various methods, but one very powerful method that he teaches is what is called aloka sanya, which means the perception of light. And that is that one takes a bright light, such as the light of the sun or the light of the full moon, and one, without staring at the sun during the middle of the day, since that could injure the eyes, but one gets a quick mental image of the sun when it's shining brightly, enough to be able to see that with one's mind's eye. And then with one's mind's eye, one tries to perceive that full, bright globe of the sun, radiating, shining, brightly, glorious, glorious, bright, scintillating, dispelling all the darkness of the mind. And then if one loses that image, then one could again look at the bright sun momentarily and then go back to visualizing the sunlight. If it's at night, one can look at the full moon or even at the light of a candle, get that light, then visualize the light brightly radiating, shining, scintillating. And that light infuses the mind so that it just drives away all the heaviness, dullness, drowsiness. Hopefully. Sometimes it doesn't work, then there are other methods that can be used, like walking briskly up and down, or sometimes one just has to splash cold water over the face. Take a cold shower. Okay, then sloth and torpor, that is on the side of dullness or sluggishness. Then restlessness and remorse, those two are on the side of disturbance or agitation. And so they have the same remedy, the same cure, and that is some type of practice of meditation that will lead to mental tranquility. So, coming to the text, abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Okay, so to overcome this restlessness and remorse, what one needs is some means of subduing the mind so that it becomes calm, tranquil, and peaceful, something that gives peace and joy to the mind. And so what is usually recommended is some type of meditation object which is naturally tranquil and peaceful. And what is generally recommended is mindfulness of the breathing, anapanasati. Since by following the breath, being mindful of the breath in and out, just that effort to attend to the breath will cause the ripples of thought to quiet down, to slow down, and the mind will have just some natural object to still the waves of thought. And so this will purify the mind from restlessness and remorse. And then the last hindrance is doubt. Abandoning doubt, He abides, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. Here it's stated very, very succinctly in the text, but what the meditation manuals usually recommend is that one, if one comes into doubt, sometimes one has to stop one's meditation and go to a teacher to get one's doubts clarified, or sometimes one has to investigate and analyze the subject which is causing one doubt. And sometimes when doubts are constantly disturbing the mind, one just has to recognize them as doubts and just realize that this is a kind of disturbance swelling up from some deep layers of the mind and not be swept away by these doubts. But just let the doubts subside during this period of meditation, let them remain in a state of abeyance. And then when one has the opportunity at a later time, then one could try to clarify the doubts. But often the doubts, this is a kind of trick that the mind plays to prevent one from succeeding in the meditation practice. At this point now, I'll ask if there are any questions. That deal in greater, I can't say that any suttas really deal with them in a lot of detail. You get more detailed treatment in commentaries. But there are suttas which deal more specifically with aspects of mental training. And this is just a very concise, repetitive passage on the abandoning of the five hindrances. There are other suttas which deal more elaborately with the specific meditation techniques for overcoming the hindrances. Like there's a stock passage on the development of the perception of the unattractive nature of the body, a stock passage on the development of loving kindness meditation. Then there are some scattered suttas on how to deal with sloth and torpor. Apart from the standard suttas on mindfulness of breathing, I don't know other suttas that deal with restlessness and remorse. And then the subject of doubt. Yeah, I don't know suttas that deal specifically with doubt, except those which speak about the need to investigate and inquire. I think, what is it? It's a question I never thought of before. So I can't say that I have the absolutely correct answer to it. I guess what is intended is that one is not certain exactly how to proceed in developing wholesome qualities. As one is developing the meditation, might not know how to go further at particular impasses one comes to in one's practice. But that wouldn't seem to be the kind of doubt that one has to overcome just through continued. That's the kind of doubt for which one would have to go and seek out a teacher for further guidance. Perhaps it's doubt whether, it's kind of skeptical doubt whether it's worthwhile cultivating these wholesome qualities, doubt about the distinction of what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. Of course, in the development, what's interesting is that in the Saṅyutta Nikāya, the set of qualities which is directly contrasted with the five hindrances are the seven factors of enlightenment, the Sats, seven factors of enlightenment. And one of the seven factors of enlightenment is called Dhammavijaya Sambhojanga, which means the, sometimes it's translated, investigation of phenomena, or discrimination of phenomena. And that is explained as one is able to discriminate which dhammas, which qualities are bright, which are dark, which are wholesome, which are unwholesome, which are blameworthy, which are blameless. Okay, so one has a clear understanding of the distinction between wholesome and unwholesome qualities through investigation. And so one who doesn't have this clear distinction, this clear discrimination, will be in doubt, not knowing what are the good qualities to develop and what are the unwholesome qualities to be overcome. Now, I pointed to you. Yeah. Mm. In this case, if it's a beautiful light, one should not be afraid of it, because this beautiful light has the effect of flooding the mind with light and dispelling the clouds of dullness and drowsiness.
I guess my question is, wouldn't there be the possibility of becoming attached to the light?
One shouldn't worry about attachment to that good light. One shouldn't worry about becoming attached to the light at this point, because this will be an attachment that helps one, inspires one to overcome obstructive states. Yes, exactly, exactly. In fact, as one goes deeper into concentration, then there will come qualities, joy and happiness, which are naturally objects of attachment. And one should not be afraid of those. The Buddha says one should not be afraid of the happiness and joy that come from seclusion, because that happiness and joy are detached from sensual desires and from unwholesome states. This is the way to draw the mind away from the attachment to the lower states, is by drawing it with a higher type of joy and happiness. People get the idea that Buddhism says give up all attachments, so one shouldn't be attached to anything. But in fact, the Buddha is a very, very skillful teacher who uses first the pull of a higher joy and happiness to lead one away from the attachment to lower things, because the mind naturally seeks joy and happiness. If there's no joy and happiness, one will not be drawn to anything. So one has to get the joy and happiness from what's called niramisa piti sukha. That's a spiritual joy and happiness. And that leads one away from amisa piti sukha. That is from carnal joy and happiness, or worldly joy and happiness. Then, once one gets firmly settled in the spiritual joy and happiness, then one has to get drawn away from the attachment to that spiritual joy and happiness. Not that one gives up the joy and happiness, but one cuts the ties of attachment to it. And then one experiences the joy and happiness which lie beyond even that spiritual joy and happiness, the ultimate joy and happiness. Both aids to enlightenment. Faith, yeah. Yeah, I would say faith goes very, very closely. It's very closely. Faith is, in a sense, the opposite of doubt here. So this is not faith in the sense of blind belief, but faith in the sense of a trusting confidence So when places, when one undertakes the practice, the development of the path, one places faith in it, and so one is not going to be drawn away from the path by doubt. It doesn't mean that one is just accepting everything blindly, but it means that one is not going to listen to the distracting calls or distracting, disturbing noise of doubt. Is that what you had in mind? Well, of those spiritual factors, you mentioned faith.
Yeah, the faith. Yeah. The sensing, the power.
Yeah. But the faculties and powers, they're quite different. Unless you are relating faith to doubt here, then there's a completely different subject from this. So I won't explain the relationship of the faculties and powers now, because it's not on the track of the sutta. Any further questions? Okay, then we'll go into the first jhana. Okay, now this passage on the abandoning of the five hindrances. It's just one paragraph, and it seems to be describing something which takes place as the meditator sits there just in one session, almost as if in one afternoon, maybe a half an hour, he just overcomes the five hindrances at once. But this could be a struggle that the meditator is undergoing, quite a drawn-out struggle for years as he's training all the accumulated sankharas or dispositions and tendencies of the mind come bubbling up to the surface with all sorts of tendencies pulling the mind in one direction, sometimes in another direction. Sometimes the mind will become very settled, calm, and tranquil. Then new layer of tendencies, dispositions will come gushing up to the surface. New obstacles and hindrances will appear out of nowhere. Then new remedies will have to be applied, or sometimes the old remedies will have to be applied again and again. So this is a process of systematic training that the meditator will have to go through over and over. So the Buddha is now taking the case of an ideal practitioner, one with very, very mature faculties. And as he continues with this practice, even over an extended period, gradually the five hindrances will start to crumble and collapse. So in paragraph 19, we come to the description of what happens when the hindrances give way. And now the meditator is becoming ready to enter into the state of full meditative absorption, which is called jhana. This entire training, which is being described now, belongs to the training and the phase of Buddhist training, which is called samadhi. Samadhi means concentration. And before the meditator attains jhana proper, according to the commentaries, though this is not mentioned in the sutta texts themselves, but according to the commentaries, there is a certain stage in attainment that the meditator will reach before entering into jhana. This stage is called access concentration, or upachara samadhi. I'll write that on the board. Usually when Theravadan Buddhists explain jhana, they will bring in a systematic way of explaining that has come down in the Pali commentaries, especially in a work called the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification. And this way of explaining the jhanas has become so ingrained within, or entrenched within, the Theravada tradition that it's almost difficult for a traditional Theravada monk to distinguish what is from commentary, what is from sutta. And so in my explanation, I want to try to keep as close as possible just to what is in the suttas and not bring in explanation from Visuddhimagga and then inject it into the suttas. Otherwise, I start lecturing on Visuddhimagga and not on Majjhima Nikaya. But sometimes it's helpful to bring in at least a few distinctions, but whenever I bring them in, then I say what I'm taking from Visuddhimagga and what is, I give like a warning label, I attach a warning label to it. Now what is interesting is that in the Visuddhimagga, a particular like list of meditation subjects has come down. And certain meditation subjects, the meditation subjects are distinguished according to whether they lead to the attainment of the jhanas or whether they don't lead to the attainment of jhanas. Now, in the suttas themselves, this is something of a puzzle to me. One doesn't find any correlation of specific meditation subjects with the attainment of the jhanas. Why is that so? I don't know. In the Visuddhimagga, it said, what are the meditation subjects that lead to the jhanas? One that leads to the jhanas is mindfulness of breathing. Another that leads, or a set of meditation subjects that lead to jhana, are the called the kasinas. The kasina, I write that on the board. The kasinas are mentioned in the suttas. What are they? Okay, the kasinas are almost impossible to translate. They are particular devices, usually circular devices, representing either an element or a color, used as objects upon which to focus the mind. So in the suttas, we have 10 kasinas. What are the 10 kasinas? Earth kasina. I'll list them then explain. Earth kasina, water kasina, fire kasina, air kasina. Those are the four element kasinas, four color kasinas, blue kasina, red kasina, yellow kasina, white kasina. And there are two more, space kasina and consciousness kasina. And what do the suttas say about the kasinas? There are, O monks, these 10 kasinas. What are the 10? Earth kasina, bop, 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 bop. Consciousness kasina. These, O monks, are the 10 kasinas. little, not much more than that is said. So it seems that these must have been commonly used meditation objects, and so when they were mentioned, there was just understood what they were. And they're still used today in meditation, not very commonly, but in hermitages, not in the modern meditation centers, but more in the monastic hermitages in Sri Lanka, perhaps in Thailand. An earth kasina will be, it's a circular disc made of clay which is spread very, very smoothly, representing the earth element, say. And the meditator will place it at a certain distance from himself and sit, focusing the mind or staring at that clay object, clay circle, looking at it for a certain amount of time, then closing the eyes, visualizing it, looking at it again, closing the eyes, visualizing it. Water kasina, well, the only kasinas that I know used, the only kasina that I know used from the elemental group is the earth kasina. I don't know anybody who's ever used water, fire, or air kasina. So the earth kasina is used, and the color kasinas are used. The color kasina will just be a circular disc made, painted with a particular color. It has to be painted very, very smoothly and very uniform. There shouldn't be variations, visible variations in the color, because that will be something of a disturbance to the concentration. And so for this, I need a college education. One has the blue or red disc. One doesn't change. One just selects one particular color that attracts one, or the color that might be assigned by the teacher that in some way suits one's character. And one focuses upon that object, again, visualizing, opening the eyes, visualizing, opening the eyes, and working over and over with it until one is able to see that object as clearly with one's eyes closed as one would be able to see it with the eyes open. Okay, so in the Visuddhimagga system, the mindfulness of breathing and the kasinas are the main meditation objects considered effective in leading to the jhanas. At this point, I will stop. And then we'll continue next week. Because if once we get into the jhanas, then that becomes a big topic in itself. Okay, any questions?
When you said that one has to fully overcome the patterns before one to be able to attain an active concentration.
The overcoming of the five hindrances marks the entry into access concentration. I'm going to sort of backtrack next week and then take the process from overcoming the five hindrances through access concentration into jhana. I won't go into any detail, but I should mention the consciousness. It's a good that you brought this up. The consciousness Kusina, the space Kusina, the consciousness Kusina in the Sutta system. Okay, the four element Kusinas, the four color Kusinas, are capable of leading to the four jhanas. Now, beyond the four jhanas, there are four other states, deeper states of samadhi, which are called the four formless attainments. The four arupa jhanas. Sometimes they call the arupa attainments, the four immaterial attainments. And one of these is called the base of infinite space. The one beyond that is called the base of infinite consciousness. And so the object for the base of infinite space is infinite space. And that infinite space is space Kusina. And then consciousness, viewed or contemplated in terms of its infinity, is the consciousness Kusina. But in order to go, you can't begin with the space Kusina or the consciousness Kusina. One first has to master the four jhanas based on either the element, one of the element Kusinas or a color Kusina. And then from the fourth jhana, one could go into the infinite space or infinite consciousness. It's all in the Visuddhi Magga. Yeah, I know. But any further questions? Okay, then we will share the merits with the deities. We share the merit with the deities, the Nagas, those are the dragons, We ask them to protect the Buddha's teaching, and to protect the exposition of the teaching, then to protect ourselves and others. Then we ask the devas, the gods, to rejoice in our merits and achieve all success. Then we ask the buddhas, the harmful spirits, to rejoice and achieve all success. Then we ask all beings to rejoice in the merits and achieve all success. Akasata jabumata devanaga mahitika Punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam Akasata jabumata devanaga mahitika Punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam Akasata jabumata devanaga mahitika Punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu mang parang etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabba Sampatti Siddhya Etavata Ca Amhehi